You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Oh, by the way, Jerry Lewis passed away. I was never a fan. He was kind of on the dumb side for me. But I had friends who thought he was really funny. I did not. All that stuff. I'm like, what is that guy? Joining me, I think from North Carolina or South Carolina, Smitty?
Pickens, South Carolina.
Where?
Pickens, South Carolina.
Pickens, South Carolina. All right.
Yeah, we're north of Clemson and west of Greenville.
Right. Isn't it pronounced Greenville, not Greenville?
Greenville, yes, you are correct.
I've been to Greenville, and you better get correct, because when you say Greenville, they look at you and they say, oh, you're not from around here, are you?
Yeah, that's right.
Which means you don't get the discount. Oh, yeah, him. Wanted to have you back on and talk about ships and also, you know, Tom Dreyer just talked about, he quoted Barack Obama talking about teachable moments. And I don't disagree with him, but I just to get your take on, and I'm going to give you a series of categories and you can tell me what you think. First of all, I think we all, those of us who've been members of the Department of Navy, wake up with a heavy heart this morning, now there's 10 sailors missing. And I haven't seen the announcement that says they transitioned to a recovery operation. But, you know, there's 10 families in this country that have their fingers crossed that their son or daughter is going to be found, as the day goes on today. Your thoughts on that?
Well, it's really inexplicable at this particular point, particularly the fact that there are now two of these types of accidents in relatively the same region. And I think we all are going to be searching for, you know, the reason that these types of things happen. But certainly, you cannot be a family member, a parent of folks that are on that ship and have any kind of, at least in my view, satisfaction that the Navy is producing the right kind of people to lead and command and manage ships on the world's oceans. That would be the first thing that would be going through my mind. So certainly our hearts and prayers go out to them as we search for the answer, and hopefully it can be corrected.
I don't think the correction is a hard one. I think it's a cultural one, in that, you know, it's about discipline when you know this kind of stuff. It's about discipline, and so I just, again, we've all been to sea, and I think those of us who've been there for a while, you know how it's supposed to work, and they're not 100% reliant on radar. Just like in our operations, we still have compasses, believe it or not. You know, just in case your GPS goes down, you better have something that tells you where the hell you are on the planet. You know, we have paper maps. We have stickies and push pins in combat operation centers in case it goes down. That as long as we can communicate on the radio, we can still operate 24/7. And you're required to maintain both, all those muscle groups in order to be able to function, in the kind of environments that we function in. And so, those things go together. So I think it's going to be painful. And I think the prelude to all of that was late last week when, 7th Fleet released a preliminary inquiry into the collision of the Fitzgerald. It only dealt with events post the collision, not prior to the collision. And then the COXO and the Command Master Chief were all relieved. They were relieved. They're taken out of those billets. I think the CO was relieved because he was of his physical injuries. But they were now relieved for disciplinary reasons, pending whatever else that's going to happen to them. So, again, this one, after that one, in my opinion, makes it 100 times worse because everybody should have got the memo. And when you see the video of the damage to the McCain, you know, they got not T-boned, but they got hit from like the left rear. And you could see the bulb of the tanker ship, you know, went right into the hull. And, it's just awful, awful, awful stuff. And I hope, and I've got email, you know, saying that, I mean, I hope there's another explanation, but I don't know what it can be. In clear weather, how do you ram into a ship that's the size of a skyscraper, for God's sakes? Right,
yeah.
Right? I mean, it's just awful. So, anyway.
I mean, it wouldn't have taken but a couple of minutes to, you know, put that ship in overdrive if they had seen, you know, the little red blip getting closer and closer, if somebody had been watching it and, you know, go flank speed, you know, two minutes of flank speed, they would have been out of, you know, out of the way. But it tells me that there was no one on physical watch, and perhaps the folks that were looking at the radar. I'd always thought, I may be wrong on this, but, you know, what happened to the clanger when, you know, I guess somebody has to physically ring a clanger when you're on a collision course with someone.
Right.
But I had thought those things were all automatic, you know, based on radar, how close you hear the clanging of, you know, on collision course. But I guess those things don't happen anymore. Maybe it's all silent, but.
Well, the other thing that I was talking to a surface warfare guy last night, and he said, well, normally when you're in the vicinity of the Malaccan Straits, there's so much traffic in that area, your watch bills are plussed up. You know?
Yeah, I would think so. Absolutely.
And it's a pretty orderly place. He said, there's lanes, and you'll see, like sea lanes, you know, when you're going east to west. You know, I think he said you stay on the right side of the lane. So you get in line and you proceed through in a very, he said it's a pretty orderly movement and there's a spot where you all merge. Now there's rules of the road at sea in terms of deferring to somebody on your left or your right, starboard or port for all you Navy people. And that's how it works. But you get in line and you go through single file for the most part. And he said, but you know, your plussed up watch bills. When I transited on the USS Ranger, we were at general quarters.
That would be a way to do it too. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and we slept at general quarters and guys rotated through posts and things like that. But that's how our ship's captain. And it was kind of because, you know, there was pirates and he didn't want to take the chance that somebody might shoot one of our aircraft on the flight deck as they drove by. So we were at general quarters the whole time. And, you know, it was a long day. But, what the hell else were we going to do on ship? Nothing. Right? Go to the gym, eat, sleep, work. You know, so you work. So, anyway. All right. Monuments. And let me give you three genres and tell me what to do. First of all, Army bases. Should they be named for Confederate generals? Statutes of public facilities that are working today, should they have Confederate statues in front of them as Black Americans, White Americans, as we all go in and out of these buildings? Is that appropriate? And what do we do? How do we treat it? So. Tell me, what do we do?
Okay, on the bases, I think that's probably a military decision. And you know, the military is commanded by a commander in chief, and it gets its funds from Congress. And so it's a, you know, policy wags the tail of the military. So I personally have no problem with it. I haven't researched the reasoning for why some of these Army bases, particularly in the South, are named after Confederate generals, like Fort Jackson and Fort Lee and AP Hill and all those.
Benning.
Why weren't they named for Union generals? I don't know.
Well, you know, this is just a guess, but I think it's probably accurate. The time when those bases were built, let's see, if you were, let's say, 25 years old in 1865, which means you were kind of young when the war started, but if you were 25, you're only 60 at the turn of the century, right? And in 1910, you're 70 years old. Your sons and daughters who've grown up listening to the Civil War, you know, are in their 30s. They are the majority, the vast majority of people that inhabit the South. And, you know, it's still the deadliest war in our nation's history. And the nation didn't go much past the Mississippi River. And so, so to me, why were those things? Well, if you're going to have a name, we would like that base to be named after one of the great Confederate generals, General Benning, who hails from Georgia. And you would have much, and the Southern Democrats were hugely powerful in our legislatures. And as part of binding the wounds, quote unquote, allowing Confederates to put up monuments on our battlefields, you know, we allowed that stuff. So as Droughty said, teachable moments, understanding our history, how we got to be like that, and then what's appropriate. I would be inclined to change the names of those bases, because to me, if were I an African American Marine working on a base that I saw, I think that would, like, what is this about? Like, you know. And I understand, so find another way to treat it. Don't bleach our history. Find another way to put up who Benning was, and also the cost of, you know, in the region, how many slaves were in the region, how many people came and died as slaves in the region, and tell the wider story. So I would lean towards that. That's just me, though. I could be wrong.
Yeah, it is interesting that I don't think there are any Marine bases other than named after any Confederate generals. I can't remember of one, but makes you think about the U.S. Army in those particular days. But anyway, you say, and General Droughty, I'd heard him on the last time too, saying these are teachable moments. Well, teachable by who? Who is to do the teaching?
Right.
And how is the teaching to be done? In other words, if it's a big deal in the state of Virginia to rename, you know, AP Hill and Fort Lee, then there should be public discussions probably on the base, and you bring in people from all around and make sure that there's good representation of all sides, and you know, raise the issue, and if there's general public consensus to rename after the education, maybe you start with an hour or two of you know, Civil War history. Make sure everybody has the facts as to, you know, what the Civil War was about, how some Southerners think it was the war for Southern independence, and a war of Northern aggression, and how those thoughts came to be, as opposed to what is currently the mantra that the war was all about and just about slavery. That has a possibility of changing minds as to about, you know, why some bases were called named after Confederate generals, and then maybe you have an easing of the tension. Because I think people are human. Once they understand the intentions and the purposes of why things were done, they have a better opportunity to back down and say, yeah, I probably was too emotional about this,
yeah.
So on and so forth. But somebody's got to take the lead. And I think, you know, the Defense Department would be a good way to start the education, to start the conversation. I'm not sure who else is going to be doing it at the point, because I think the Defense Department right now is pretty neutral.
Right.
I
don't know if the DOD. Come on, the DOD's got enough to do. To me, it's if you own this. Well, in terms of the names, I think Congress, the House and Senate Armed Service Committees ought to take that up. And they, in my opinion, they ought to give the DOD some direction. And working, you know, after testimony with DOD historians and things like that. And I think that's appropriate. And I think you have two options. But don't bleach our history. Tell the whole story why it was named Benning. But also tell the story about slavery. First of all, you know, I'm educating myself. You know, in 1776, who outlawed slavery on the planet? In 1861, who outlawed slavery on the planet? So, I think as we've all heard, and I think most of us agree, that judging historical figures by contemporary standards is not really fair. Okay?
Well, not only is it not fair, it's just, it's stupid. It's ignorance. It's your emotions, once again, getting the best of you. It's what you think the way things should be imposed upon the past. And we just can't do that. I mean, once again, that's just a human reaction to something that has happened terrible in our past. And there are many examples of that type of emotional reaction to things that we've done in the past. And slavery is just one of them.
Right.
Not a time for emotional outbursts. It's time for calm reason. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of that going around. The other thing, just in terms of my own education, in 1861, how much of the world outlawed slavery? You know, and even when you judge Jefferson and Washington, if the majority of all the landowners in the region all owned slaves, okay, for them to release them upon their death, was that a magnanimous gesture in 1790, whatever it was, when they died, or 18 early, whatever, when they passed away? Were they magnanimous men for that gesture in and of itself? Although to us it looks bullshit. You know, but given their contemporary society, were they truly men that stood out like that because of those actions? We don't have any sense of that because we're not educated.
Yeah, we immediately. That's right. We immediately tend to call them racists and bigots, right, and rapists and things like that. But they weren't back in those days. They weren't from a perspective of now. Looking back, you can erroneously call them that, but I don't think they were. That was just the way it was. I mean,
they're the same guys who write the founding documents, right? Right. But again, were they perfect? No. Okay. They weren't perfect. So get over that notion. Study it for what it is, and then come to grips with it. And again, for Americans, to include the whole notion of slavery. To include Lincoln's letter to Horace Greeley, as the president, my goal is to save the Union. If I can save the Union and not free a slave, I will do it. If I can save the Union, free some slaves and not others, I will do that. If I can save the Union and it requires that I release all the slaves, I will do that. But my as the president, my priority is to save the Union. My personal opinion is slavery is a stain on the nation's fabric, and it doesn't belong in our nation. But so again, wait a minute. I thought he was a great emancipator. Well, no, but when we communicate in 140 characters and the 24-hour news cycle, you know, puts on the high Hitler dudes, you know, I mean, I don't know that education and teachable moments have a shot. What about Confederate statues out in front of courthouses that are functioning in our democracy? Is that because to me you have one of two options: either take it, put it in a museum, or put it in a place where you could tell the whole story. And this is what I would tell counties, communities, you know, or build something out there that tells the more complete story of. This was erected by, you know, Daughters of the Confederacy, whose fathers fought in the costliest war in our nation's history. The war was about, you know, a combination of what they perceived to be states' rights and the issue of slavery. was key among them. And then the other side of that is in our county, you know, and I find it interesting that New Orleans, of all places, took down those statues and is attempting to bleach its history. Because any idea what the number one port of entry for slaves into this country was? I'll give you seven guesses. I'll give you seven guesses, Smitty. Yeah.
Well, let me guess New Orleans.
that would be a good one. Slave market here, slave market there, slave market there. Tell the story and don't run from it. Because that leads, I think, to me, that's what communities are faced with. You can bleach it or you can tell the story now. And so is the story best told at a museum with a broader exhibit? Maybe. Is it better told in a park where we'll move this entire pedestal, the statue, and then we'll build something out that tells the story more completely? So don't bleach it, but tell the broader story. Am I wrong about that?
No, for example, in Charleston, one of the last trips I made through Charleston, I went to the slave market. They turned it into a museum. It was well done. It told the story. There wasn't any monuments out front. And I think that is probably, the correct way to do it. I don't know if you read there was a story in the Post this morning about the big Confederate monument in Brandenburg, Kentucky. You know, here's a Union state. It was a neutral state, but it sided on the Union late in the war. But it was a slave state. A year or so ago, the mayor of Louisville, a neighboring town, and a University of Louisville professor just unilaterally decided to take that statue down without asking the people of Brandenburg or any of these other people. So eventually, after it was removed, the people of Brandenburg got together and said, "Hey, we're going to put it back." And we have a voice about what it is that we like to portray. So here you got, a pretty neutral, but a Union state, who is on, both sides of the story. They have other monuments in the city of Brandenburg. They've got a statue to the Underground Railroad. They've got Native American monuments. So, these are some pretty, common sense, folks, and I think that's the way it's done. The local people take charge of their history, the comments by the folks who were interviewed say, "Hey, it's part of history. It's part of our bad history, but we don't want to, take it away. It's teachable. It's what we learn from." And so I was thinking about it. What is it that we do about the monuments? Well, the monuments were what we did to bring to light the thing that wasn't necessarily good about our country. The monuments were the thing that helped us get over it, to deal with the issue and the problem. So that's why I think removing, bleaching out monuments is not going to work. It's gonna fester the boil. I think and folks like these Kentuckians in Brandenburg, they got the right approach. You don't want to let the boil fester. You want to, deal with it, which is, education, teaching. We'll make the decision about what happens, not the politicians, not the university professors, and do it the right way. And in some cases.
Interesting.
That monument, where it is, what it says on it, is an eyesore. It's a blight, based on the people that live in the particular county or the city, and it comes down, they move it to a cemetery or they move it to a museum, which I think in and of itself are both appropriate choices.
Got it. All right, sir. Good luck in the wood shop today.
Yeah, thanks, buddy.
All right, thanks for the visit. That is Phil Smith here on a Monday morning edition of All Marine Radio. Montana Man joins us next. As we continue this discussion, I'll read you an email. "Hey, Mac, as a Navy veteran, I so want to tell you to stick it up your arrogant Marine asses, but my heart hangs heavy because there's elements of truth to what you say. I do believe that the Navy is not the same Navy that I joined nearly 30 years ago. It pains me to say that. When I joined, it was a pretty rough going place. And if you got caught screwing it up, they let you have it. The Navy I see now is vastly different. Like a lot of veterans of the Navy, I'm extremely proud of my service. I hope what they find in these investigations is something other than negligence. I have a grandson serving in the Navy now. To think that he would lose his life because somebody was fucking around on watch to the extent that an oil tanker would move from the horizon to impact the ship. That is not a short amount of time. Normally, at sea, 12 miles from the horizon to your vessel. That is not fucking off a little bit. That is gross dereliction of your duty. How there isn't some kind of radar automatic sound, I'm not sure. I heard one of your guests to allude to that. I would think there would be. That would give you plenty of time to respond. Maybe somebody shut those off in both cases. In any case, I am with you this morning. My heart is heavy for the Department of the Navy. But more than that, as a member of the United States Navy, inside the Department of the Navy, I'm embarrassed. I do believe they'll find negligence in both cases because we both know there is no excuse for this shit. God bless the 10 missing sailors. Let's hope they find all of them alive. My heart absolutely breaks for their families. I cannot imagine attending my grandson's funeral were he killed in an incident like this. It wouldn't simply break my heart, it would crush my heart. And I do believe that I would hate the Navy after that. It is a sacred trust that we go to sea with, especially as we become leaders in any branch of the service. I don't think you guys are being too hard on the Navy. It is what it is. And once we get afraid to call it what it is, then I think we do a disservice. Hopefully the Navy will prove otherwise, but I'm with you. I believe it's absolute negligence. I hope that the people involved in the negligence on the USS Fitzgerald go to the brig. The Navy does need to be booted in the ass. The events in the Persian Gulf are embarrassing. Surrendering that boat, embarrassing. The fact that these Iranian patrol craft come within touching distance of United States naval vessels is an absolute joke. I heard you one day talking about what is the Navy going to do? Fire after it takes incoming and has sailors killed? At that point, will they defend themselves? And when I heard you say that, I said to myself, he's right. That's what it will take. Because the last thing the captain of a ship wants to do is have to be accountable for why he defended the ship and killed Iranian sailors. Sad state of affairs in the Navy. I hope the Secretary of Defense gets after them, because only good will come of it. I enjoy the program. Don't ever be afraid to be honest. It's what truly being an American is about. I think that the Army bases should change their names. If there's any Navy bases that are named for Confederate naval vessels, I believe that ought to be changed to include the Chancellorsville. Glorifying that battle, which was a resounding Confederate victory, is not the job of the United States Navy. It is for Southern historians to do that. Have a great day. Enjoy the program. Thanks. Montana Man joins us next on a Monday. Don't touch that dial.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military, for a first responder, for a hunter, for an outdoorsman, or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. Battlemug.com.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner, proven and dependable.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the SOF community should be aware of.
The Global SOF Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit veteranscrisisline.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
.46 on a Monday. A lot of news over the weekend. And this just in. Regional police in Barcelona report shooting a man wearing possibly an explosive belt in a town outside of Barcelona. So it continues. Joining me from Montana is Montana Man of all people, otherwise known as Rob Schwartz. So, Montana Man, what's up? How are you?
Oh, just enjoying life.
How's your buddy's kid doing in the Little League World Series? How'd they wind up doing?
They won yesterday, so they're 2-0. There's two teams eliminated out of eight on the U.S. side. And then two are 2-0, and then I guess that makes the four others are 1-1. So they're sitting pretty.
Wow. Now tell everybody who this kid is and what team he plays for.
He plays for the Lufkin team, but now they're labeled as the Southwest because they won that region. A lieutenant buddy, OCS, TBS, First Battalion, 7th Marines in Somalia, roommate in 29 Palms. It's his kid.
So this runs
buddy down in Texas.
This runs deep then.
Yeah, no, I've hunted with Blake since he was old enough to hunt. So it's been 4 or 5 years we've had him out. And he's a hell of a shortstop. He's not much with the bat, but he if the ball goes his way anywhere. I mean, backing up the second baseman last night, he's pretty dang good on the defense, but I wouldn't count on him for too much run production.
We'll work on that. How old is
he? Yeah.
You know, one of the most basic pieces of advice I give young players, and it's amazing, the effect, is if you ask them, if you see good athletes and they're struggling to hit, you say, when do you decide that you're gonna hit? And they say, well, I make sure it's a strike, and then I swing. And the answer to that is no. And they look at you like, what? And I'll never forget, my dad hardly ever got to watch me play, but he came to watch me when I was 11. And I was a left-hand hitter, and I used to hit the ball up the middle and to left field, which is the opposite field for a left-hand hitter. And he asked me that, and we're driving home. And I'm a little kid, and I tell him, and he says, that's wrong. I said, what? He said, in your head, you're going to crush everything, and then you stop if it's a ball. He said, do you understand the difference? In your head, you're going to swing. You're not identifying it as a strike and then swinging. You're going to swing, and then you stop yourself. And that's how you turn on more pitches. You'll hit balls harder like that. And I went, oh. And it was a small piece of advice. But in my brain, it was huge, and I started to hit the ball hard after that as a little leaguer. And I remember when somebody said, what happened to you? And I said, just a stupid conversation with my dad. But it kind of turns you from being like a defensive reactionary hitter to I'm crushing this thing. And then if it's a ball, you stop yourself. So you could sound really smart if you gave him that advice, so just so you know.
Yeah, I think it's a little far into it
okay. Now. All right. Well,
next year I'll have that.
In the off season, you could have that conversation.
Yeah, we're hunting in October.
We're hunting in Montana or Texas?
Texas, down there, cleaning out some deer for a buddy on a ranch he runs down there.
The we're talking ships and monuments today.
We're not talking Red Sox Yankees at all.
We can talk about that. We can talk about that if you want to. But we'll get to that here in a few minutes.
All right.
Your thoughts. Heard the news, obviously, like the rest of us, relative to the USS McCain. Your thoughts when you heard that?
I think just like everybody else that's been on this morning, from what I've heard, I mean, how do we do it again? I mean, this is 4 in 1 year. We're going to run out of ships, for Christ's sakes. I mean,
you know,
we're going to have a nutrition problem at this rate.
That's no joke. You only have so many ships that can go to sea. And these things have to go offline for a year. And the preliminary report from the McCain is there's substantial structural damage to the ship.
Yeah, that's a big hole.
That's a big deal. Now, somebody who thought they were deploying in like 4 or 5 months is going to sea in 30 days, and that's fast.
Yeah.
And it changes, and you have now you have the Fitzgerald is out of rotation too. So, and when the whole sequestration has had an effect on the fleet, so not a good thing. How does this thing happen on the heels of, like you said, this is the fourth one, the second one that, where we've lost lives in less than 60 days.
Yeah. I mean, and the part that gets me is it was 2 destroyers and 2 cruisers. So these are the carrier or the expeditionary strike group. These are the guys that are responsible for tracking plots to protect that entire strike group. You know, they're the main ones in charge of keeping track of everything around you. I mean, how do they run into something? That's
how do they?
That baffles me.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, again, and just like when, like running a COC, you have to be able to run it with no power, with no data, and maybe one comm link. So paper maps, World War II style, paper maps, you know, yellow canaries, passing messages. That's all part of it. That's a part of the way we do business because you can't always count on technology, and that's why to this date, you know, American warships have people up in the quote-unquote crow's nest with night vision goggles and binoculars that's their job to watch the external part of the ship, and that hasn't changed in the current watch configuration despite all the technology. So that's what makes it so troubling and befuddling.
And I was always amazed at how rudimentary the Navy still was when it came to those things. You know, you're thinking, God, you know, you go from RCOC where everything's done on a computer, lights are turned low because everybody's got to pay attention to that screen, and we're tracking aircraft, we're tracking units, and they're doing the same thing on ship. You know, they're tracking aircraft and they're tracking vessels, but then they had guys standing outside with that microphone thing that hangs around their neck and a pair of binoculars. And I was like, God, do we really need this in this day and age? But you go, I mean, yeah, of course we do. That's your fallback. That's the thing that's never going to fail, is that kid out there with a pair of binoculars and that funky microphone thing that hangs around his neck and pokes right up into his face.
Right.
To be able to get word into the guy steering the ship of what the hell's going on out there. And in the middle of the day, it's like, God dang, man. What were they doing?
Yeah, that's what, again, and, you know, we muse about that, right? But the bottom line is, and this is what you've heard us talk about on this program repeatedly, you've heard Rob talk about what it was like to go to the cache and see young guys with their bodies just blown to shit. And, you know, and I remember, and I said this before, but my thought was always, you know, there's a family that has no idea what's coming their direction. And, you know, that's in combat when, you know, you're trying as hard as you can. This is straight up negligence, and 10 families are gonna bury their kids because people can't do their jobs. It's just extremely disheartening. And, you know, I hope the Secretary of Defense puts his boot so far up the Navy's ass, he's wiggling his toes out somebody's nose, because this is disgusting. Because again, there's no, I don't care what somebody says, and I'll read you an email. hey, Mac, maybe this for an explanation. Maybe he had technology issues. Maybe they were working a problem. People had their head down. What is the closing distance between the horizon and a ship? I'm not exactly sure. How many minutes would that be? They clearly both were not traveling in the same direction, or maybe they were, and simply crossed bows. Any idea how much time that would be? I don't. Rob, you have any idea how much time that would be?
I don't. I mean, those ships probably, I mean, they can go pretty quick. I mean, the cruisers and destroyers, that tanker cannot. I mean, that, it doesn't travel at that quick a speed.
Right.
But, I mean, over the horizon is over the horizon, and you've got to have time. And those are smaller ships that are much more maneuverable than amphibs and big amphibs. And, I mean, they have a little bit of agility to them for being a naval vessel. Anyway, there had to be ample reaction time.
Yeah.
It's a couple minutes to probably get out of the way. So 12 miles over the horizon just for visual. Think about it.
Hold on, let me.
It's got to take them close to, I mean, at least 45 minutes.
How fast? Let's say 18 knots.
God, that's pretty quick, wouldn't you think?
Now, that's pretty quick, but speed distance time calculator. Speed. Nautical mile? A knot. Okay, so 18, yeah. 18 knots. Distance, 12 miles. Calculate. 34 minutes. So 35 minutes to go at 18 knots to cover 12 miles. That's from the horizon at sea. So again,
so you had a half an hour.
So you had a half an hour.
And I think that's probably less time than really they would really have.
Right. And again, depending if you were closing or whatever. If you're steaming in the same direction, it's going to take, and one is going faster than the other, they'll be overtaken. That takes a longer period of time. If you're converging, it'll take a shorter period of time. So I'm not exactly sure the geometry of the incident. So, but again, look at 35 minutes as kind of a benchmark to closing, on a stationary object. Here's an email. Mac, I'm curious. Do neither commercial vessels bear any responsibility for this? Rob?
Say that again.
Either commercial vessel bear any responsibility?
Well, yeah, I would think. I mean, those tankers, though, I would say they would have less just because they're probably less capable. And they're probably going slower, and they're a lot less agile.
And I'll tell you, they don't like to admit it, but a lot of times they throw those things in open water. They throw them on autopilot, and they're not on the bridge.
Yeah.
And I was on the Ranger. We off the coast of California, we almost collided with one. And I got my ass yanked into the XO of the ship's office the next morning, and he said, the first lieutenant, Lieutenant McNamara, why did you not tell the junior officer of the day that there was a tanker off the starboard beam? I said, sir, I told him twice. He said, what? I said, I told him on two separate occasions, and he told me, we got it. Thank you. And so he asked me to explain. And, I mean, like, and it was not an informal inquiry at all. It was in his in-state, in his in-port cabin, which was huge, in front of his big desk, Lieutenant McNamara report to the ship's executive officer of a aircraft carrier. And he was pissed. And when I told him that I had told him twice, he got really pissed because somebody didn't tell him the whole truth. And so he made me explain. I said, sir, look, I've never been up on your bridge. I'm not part of your nav section. My responsibility is the 12 50 caliber machine guns that encircle the ship. And he said, I understand that. And I said, the starboard sponson, gun mount number 4 reported to me that there was a ship, on the horizon, and it looked like we were going to cross bows. I reported that to the JOD. He said, we've got it. And I said, probably 10 minutes later, my guys said again, hey, sir, if we don't change course, we're going to get close. And I said, got it. I've told them. They say they've accounted for it. And I stood there and I wondered if I should, you know, bring this up again because they told me they had it. But I thought that I should, so I asked a second time. And they looked at me and they said, hey, Mac, we've got this. I said, all right. And then the next thing you know, the navigator walks out and he sees this ship. He says, prepare to sound the collision alarm, wake the CO. CO comes on the bridge, tying his robe from his NC cabin at like 4 in the morning. Prepare to come to this course, stand by to sound the collision alarm. He was like cool as the underside of the pillow. I was like, damn, that's why he's in charge of this thing. And, yeah. So, we didn't sound the collision alarm. And, but, I mean, craziness. So, I don't
know. Did they ever, and I haven't looked about what came out of the Lake Champlain and the Antietam investigations. I mean, I figured they should have some information out on those. Was it human or was it, equipment error?
I have not.
Contributing to those things.
Yeah, that's on my list of things to look up today. But I have not. Let me get your thoughts on, monuments. What do we do about monuments? What do we do about bases named for Confederate generals? Your thoughts?
Bases?
Yeah,
bases.
What do we do about that? Just for the sake of discussion, suppose that you're a black American and go to work at Fort Jackson every day or Fort Benning. Is that a good thing? Is that right thing? Is that just a matter of history? Your thoughts?
Yeah, when you frame it that way, it makes you look at it a little bit different, and it makes you think, you know, that's probably not right. Whose responsibility is it to preserve history, and how should it be done, I think, is the question. And naming active military bases after Confederate generals probably is not appropriate, is where I'm coming from. Now, the community's monuments and things that aren't run by the federal government, I think that's a community issue at that point.
Right. What about the bleaching of history? Do you believe that? See, I don't know if you've heard, but my thought is that hey, look, this is a teaching moment, man. To be honest with you, I'm learning, you know, and just this, you know. 12 of our first 18 presidents, including Grant, at some point, were slave owners in their lives. So if we might look and say, Washington releasing his slaves in his will, you know, what a bullshit. Why didn't he release them when he was alive? But if Washington lives in a time when everybody in the region has slaves, and it's not a social thing, it's a business thing, and that's part of his business, and he accounts to release them upon his death. He's actually atypical for his time. He's a progressive for his time because other people aren't doing that. But
they passed on, and they will.
When we don't look at it, history, I think in the context of, and for instance, in 1776, what nation did Britain still allow slavery? Because a lot of slaves came out of the Dutch Indies, right? And the Brits were huge in that part of the world. So I don't know, to me, teachable moments. But when we communicate by Twitter, you don't hear so much of that discourse, which is painful.
Yeah, but then the grown-ups are the ones that need to deal with it and step in. And I think on the monument level and the local level, you know, city council, county commissioners, all those people need to make that decision. As far as the federal military bases, I think that it's not a teachable moment. It's not what it's named for. It's to recognize a military figure. Now, thinking about it, in the how many countries that were victorious in a war are there the opposing countries' monuments been allowed to stand or been allowed to stay there? You know, the North appeasing the South by letting them put monuments up
right.
at the time to recognize their effort in the war was appropriate at that time.
Well, I mean, it was a way to bind the nation together again, just like allowing
exactly.
the South to put up their monuments on. That was a huge controversy post Civil War because the people were not okay with that at the time. I mean, that war was tremendously costly, and they had seceded, they had betrayed the Union, but it was decided that in the interest of binding the nation. So to me, the teaching starts in all kinds of ways. Why are they even there to begin with? Right? Why
yeah,
is this here?
Exactly.
And what was the sentiment? There wasn't a community. The country didn't go much past the Mississippi, yet it was the costliest war of our time. In 3 days at Gettysburg, you lose almost as many killed in Gettysburg as you lose in all of Vietnam. It's incredible, the numbers. And so every community was touched in a big way. And so, again, the teachable moment, I think, is huge. But I just don't know in a society that lives on CNN and Fox News and Twitter that we're going to get that. And I like you, like I think, and I love that phrase, the adults. When are the adults going to show up and straighten this shit out? You know, where's my mom? Where's my dad? You know, when are they showing up to get this shit under control? So I'm with you, but I and I'm also with you. I think it's inappropriate that active duty federal military installations are named for them because I think it is. But I say that you should have construct. Don't bleach history. You should construct a little kiosk at the entrance of the base, and it should be Fort Benning was named after General whatever Thomas Benning. Fought in the Civil War, yada, yada, yada. Also, in Georgia, the story of slavery is this. There was 2.7 million people enslaved between, you know, and just tell in this county, you know, not far from where you're standing, you know, there was a slave market on the corner of this street and this street at which, you know, an estimated 400,000 people were sold into slavery. And make it personal and real and tell the whole story and then rename the base, but don't bleach your history. Does that make sense or is that me?
No, that makes sense, and that's kind of a grown-up talking, which you don't get much of nowadays. And if folks would sit down and have a conversation like that and leave the emotion out of it, then I think this is pretty easily solved. And how many does every military base have a museum on it? I would think just about is what I'm coming up with as I think through it. You know, that's a great spot for it, and putting that teachable moment in. But who's responsible to preserve that history is a question, I think. Because you say, you know, we pull all these monuments off of public ground, whether it's the courthouse or whatnot, because that's public. Okay, where do they go and where do we teach it from? Well, unless you've got a private organization that's going to, you know, fork up the money to make that teaching moment happen, then it may get whitewashed. You know, who's going to take that responsibility to teach this back?
Well, there again, I think if it's an important moment, then we ought to find the money someplace because it's not just us and our kids that are going to see this. This is going to be for decades and for kids that are going to come and see it for decades. And is it worth the investment? Our history, I mean, I certainly would.